Modern Rome, the Campo Vicino. Perhaps we can start by walking through the subject a bit. It's a view of the Roman Forum with its antique monuments and its Baroque churches, and of course its modern inhabitants in the left foreground. So we have remnants of the Temple of Vespasian, Temple of Saturn, the Temple of Castor and Pollux, the Basilica of Maxentius and Constantine, and of course the Colosseum, which is one that we all recognize, the Arch of Septimius Severus down here, and then the great Baroque churches. The church designed by Cortona of Santi Luca e Martina, which is also the church of the Painters Guild, which is perhaps the reason why its golden dome is so carefully highlighted in the picture. So there's also the church of San Lorenzo in Miranda, the church of the Lateran, the church of Santa Francesca Romana. And then down here, sort of on the left side, we have this religious procession that's taken place. A woman possibly lying out her laundry to dry. And then this group of goat herds down here with these very charming goats on the hillside as well. So there's an insertion of modern life as it continues in Rome amid the splendor of its ruins and its Baroque past. And then there's also a suggestion of archaeology, which is really sort of a modern phenomenon that's happening in Rome in this period. There's this tiny figure over here ascending a ladder, apparently to examine one of the columns of the Temple of Saturn. And then there is down here what appears to be an excavation taking place on the floor of the forum. Exactly which excavation it is, we've been trying to sort of puzzle out. We're not entirely sure. But that may have to do with the fact that this scene, even in all the detail of its topography and its careful rendering of these different buildings, is a kind of recollection for Turner. Completed in 1839, the picture was painted by Turner 10 years after his last trip to Rome. So he visited Rome in 1819 and again in the winter of 1828 to 29. And so there's this sense that he's remembering Rome in a sort of poetic way that is not always completely exact in its representation of spatial relationships, its representation of scale, and so forth. It's more of a sort of poetic recollection than a precise topographical view. Of course, it's not just the topography and the rendering of monuments and so forth that make this such an extraordinary painting. It is, above all, his ability to render light in this spectacular and iridescent way. The light in the picture comes from two sources. The first is the moon over here, rendered in this thickly impasted white. And then over here, we have the sunset streaming down over the Capitoline Hill, and the two sort of come together to create this rainbow effect that really is quite wonderful. The idea for this dual light source, dual light sources were something that he played with in a number of his pictures. If you know his Neapolitan Fisher Girls Surprised Bathing by Moonlight at the Huntington, that's also a picture with multiple light sources. And another very famous picture that he exhibited at the same exhibition of the Royal Academy in 1839 is The Fighting Temeraire, towed to its last berth, which is now in the National Gallery, also has a sun and moon out at the same time. However, the specific reference of the sun and moon being simultaneously present in this picture is to a poem by Byron, the epic Child Harold's Pilgrimage, which is the story of an Englishman's journey to Rome and his aesthetic and spiritual self-discovery there. And Turner, in the catalog that accompanied this Royal Academy exhibition, excerpted in the entry devoted to this painting a little piece of that poem, which he actually misquoted slightly. So the entry in the catalog was, "The moon is out and yet it is not night. The sun as yet divides the sky with her." So the actual quotation, I'm going to go ahead and read the two surrounding cantos from the poem, which really exactly describe what's going on in this painting if you read it in totality. So, "The commonwealth of kings, the men of Rome, and even since and now fair Italy, thou art the garden of the world, the home of all art yields and nature can decree, even in thy desert what is like to thee. Thy very weeds are beautiful, thy waste more rich than other climes' fertility, thy wreck a glory, and thy ruin graced with an immaculate charm that cannot be defaced. The moon is up, and yet it is not night. Sunset divides the sky with her. A sea of glory streams along the alpine height of blue Friuli's mountains. Heaven is free from clouds, but of all colors seems to be melted to one vast iris of the west." So the actual idea of a kind of rainbow light cast by these two sources exists in the text of the poem. And for Turner's viewers at the Royal Academy exhibition in 1839, this poem would have been intimately familiar. Just the fact that Turner sort of casually misquoted it in the catalog entry, I think, suggests the extent to which he was just familiar with the poem and felt that he could quote it without looking up the specific reference, as he could have, since we know that he owned the complete works of Byron. The idea of setting this picture on a level with Childe Harold's Pilgrimage, I think, is quite apt, since we can, in some respects, regard Turner as a kind of painterly equivalent to the poetic genius of Byron, Byron being the great sort of heroic English romantic poet, and Turner being the great English heroic romantic painter, although also arguably simply the greatest English painter of all time. So how can we define Turner's genius? I think that in some ways it's helpful to break it up into three parts to understand sort of different facets of what I think that we can go ahead and call his genius. First certainly would be his handling of light and chromatic effects. Close observation of nature, certainly, but then expanded and dramatized, theatricalized. So effects of light and color found in nature then stretched to the nth degree to what critics at the time called a kind of extravagance. So he shocked a lot of critics and a lot of his academic colleagues with his use of a lot of white in his pictures, a lot of yellow. One critic said that he had yellow fever, that he used too much yellow in his pictures. And many critics of this painting in particular said that he stretched nature, stretched truth too far, and turned it into something rather immodest and extravagant. But in a copy of the exhibition catalog that we actually have at the GRI, which is annotated by a lady, she mentions this criticism of the painting as an extravaganza, and says, as extravagant as it might seem, it is still much less extravagant than nature itself. So certainly I think we have to see part of Turner's genius as this ability to paint light in some pure way. I mean, the sense that the painting itself in this gallery seems to emit light into the room is really quite an extraordinary feat. So in addition to this component of his genius, I think we have to think about his self-comparison to great artists of the past. So rather than attempt to compete with his academic colleagues of the period, although he was, of course, competing with them for patronage and commissions and so forth, he set himself up against Raphael and Titian and Poussin and, above all, Claude Lorrain, the great French landscape painter of the 17th century. So this is the moment when he's painting is also the moment, actually, 1839, this picture, when the Royal Academy relocates from Somerset House to Burlington House, where it was housed in the same building as the new National Gallery of England that housed works by painters like Claude. And so, in fact, when Turner dies in 1851, he leaves the contents of his studio and his own collection of his own work, the bulk of it, to the state, to the British nation, on the condition that a number of his pictures be displayed opposite specific pictures by Claude, which is this wonderfully sort of hubristic thing to do, and is a kind of brash self-promotion in a way, but also shows a kind of foresight that he would be regarded on the same level with Claude particularly and with the old masters more generally. And so then maybe the third kind of component of his genius, in addition to this self-marketing or positioning against the old masters and his treatment of light, is just the radical experimentation of his technique. So this had partly to do with his admixture of different thinning agents into his paint to make it more liquid, to allow him to paint more quickly. So he was mixing funny things in. Linseed oil, some people reported that he mixed in beer, actually, with his pigments. So this is before paint was sold in tubes. Paint in tubes doesn't come on the market in England until 1841. We don't know for sure if he used it thereafter. But he would have been buying his colors from so-called color men, these sort of pigment merchants, the chemical composition of whose colors is not always totally reliable in the way that it would react to these different things that he mixed in, which has led to condition problems in a lot of Turners. So, and we'll come back to that question of condition in just a moment. So in addition to his sort of experiments with pigment, there was also sort of the public performance of the act of painting that was a big part of Turner's practice. So every May, when the Royal Academy exhibition would open, he was a member of the Royal Academy beginning in 1804, and he, as a professor in the Academy schools of perspective, he became one of the Academy's most powerful and influential members. So he exhibited basically every year. So the opening would happen on the first Monday in May, which was to be preceded by what was called Varnishing Day, which was an opportunity for painters to come into the galleries, sometimes with a sort of select public also allowed in, and apply a layer of varnish to their recently dried canvases, sometimes do a little touching up. Varnishing Day under Turner's tenure stretched out into a space of 3 days, and Turner was not one simply to touch up or varnish his canvases during this period when he had the captive audience. Instead, he would submit to the exhibitions canvases that were often little more than sketches. And so on Varnishing Day, he would come in and completely rework the entire painted surface of his pictures, changing compositions, changing color schemes, in a sort of almost like action painting, sort of performance art. So it was a way of promoting himself and certainly setting his pictures apart from their neighbors on the wall. Because you have to remember that a picture like this would have been hung beside other pictures, frame to frame, floor to ceiling. And so part of the reason, I think, for this high-keyed palette of Turner's great later work was also to set his pictures apart from their neighbors. So as much as he's setting himself up against the old masters, he's also pretty actively competing with his colleagues. So the wonderful theatrics of Varnishing Day and these experimentations with the composition of his paints have led to a lot of condition problems. Instability in the chemical makeup of the painted surfaces, and then also, of course, when Turner's come onto the market, because he's such a beloved painter, in a way like Titian, whose work also has a lot of condition issues, his pictures have often been overcleaned. So this is another way in which this particular painting is so extraordinary. It has had really only two owners, and it has been under glass since 1878. So we can see portions of the picture that are probably Turner's own retouchings, likely sort of on Varnishing Day. For example, this wet calligraphic brushwork that defines the foliage here in the foreground, that seems very likely to have been applied on Varnishing Day. And then over here, if you get in really close, you can see this pattern of crackolore that's slightly inpainted with pigment that's gone a little orange in the cracks. So that's likely Turner's own retouching, that the surface of the paint had dried in an uneven and funny way by the time he finished the canvas, causing some cracking to happen. And so he went in himself and inpainted those cracks, and even possibly added this staff and little still life motif over here as a way of distracting the eye from what was going on with the condition of the paint. So we have all of this wonderfully preserved, partly because it's a picture that appears never to have been cleaned, never to have been restored, and never to have been heat-lined. So its condition really is the standard by which all other paintings by Turner need to be assessed. It's really an extraordinary thing to have here, and that's another reason why keeping it under glass. Its first owner was Hugh Monroe of Navarre, who was Turner's great friend and patron. He amassed the largest private collection of Turner's ever, and he bought it right off the wall of the exhibition in 1839. His heirs then sold it in 1878 to the newlywed couple of Hannah Rothschild and the fifth Earl of Rosebery, and it has remained in the Rosebery family until July of 2010. It was the Rosebery's who put it under glass, and so we're tremendously grateful to them for keeping it in such exquisite condition. There will also be a great opportunity in the coming month or two to see some other great Turners at the Getty, because the British Watercolors and Drawings exhibition will include our two very beautiful Turner watercolors. So if it's more Turner you're longing for, then more Turner you shall have. And then, of course, there are the two wonderful Turners at the Huntington, as well as a Turner at LACMA. So LA is very rich in Turners at this moment. Well, thank you very much for coming.